come to order. It's, I don't know what time it is. Let's see, 1:35. March 16th, we have Representatives Keller, Representative Pruitt, Representative Gruenberg, Vice Chair Thompson, Chair Gatto. Housekeeping, turn off your cell phones, please. Confirmation of Donald Hasp, I'm sorry it's pronounced Hayes, that was held over from the previous Monday. As soon as we get him online, we may interrupt whatever we're doing. So while we're waiting to get him online, we'll move to House Bill 114, the opt-out charitable giving program, and I know who sponsored that bill. You can do it from here, you can do it from there.
So, Chair Gatto, I'd move that we address Resolution Committee Substitute M2.
No, wait a second.
Okay.
You want to introduce the bill?
Yes, I would.
We might as well introduce the bill. That'll get us started on the right track.
All right, Chairman Gatto.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Chairman Gatto, and members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Steve Thompson, representative from District 10 in Fairbanks. And today I'm presenting a bill that was brought to my attention by our local electrical cooperative, Golden Valley Electric Association. Opt-out charitable giving programs have been around for many years. More than 250 cooperatives across the United States have implemented similar programs, generally referred to as Roundup programs. These programs enable individuals to contribute small amounts of change to help build a strong local community. This program is consistent with one of the seven cooperative principles, which is concern for the community. This principle reads, while focusing on members' needs, cooperatives work for the sustainable development of their communities through policies accepted by their members. Opt-out charitable giving programs by giving back to the community exemplifying this principle. The program rounds up monthly bills to the next highest dollar, so the monthly contribution is anywhere from 1 cent to 99 cents. These small amounts add up quickly. Collected funds are dispersed to qualified organizations and individuals within the cooperative's service district. Organizations and individuals are encouraged to compete and to submit written applications outlining their level of need and the benefit of receiving the funds. Some examples, an exam table for a health clinic for $2,400, new computers for the library, a matching fund for $2,500, a microscope for an elementary school, $530, and the list goes on to many very worthy, worthwhile projects. A pickup for a fire department, matching grants for a recreational center. Most cooperatives distribute the funds through the board of a separately created 501c3 organization that they have established. The board represents a cross-section of the membership, with each voting district being represented. Among more than 250 cooperatives with charitable giving programs, most have adopted opt-out programs rather than opt-in programs. Data research shows that opt-out programs have a significantly higher member involvement, with 90% member participation. Members may choose to opt out of the program at any time. This may be done in person at the cooperative, in writing, by telephone, or by using the internet. Also, if requested, donations stretching back as far as 3 years will be refunded in full. This legislation will clarify a possible conflict with Alaska Statute 45.45.930 dealing with opt-out marketing plans. Members have a voice. Opt-out charitable giving programs in Alaska would require the following. Membership approval before the program is implemented. The cooperative membership must vote in favor of the program. Disclosure on the bill. The amount added after rounding to the next dollar will be identified on the bill along with an explanation on how to opt out. Extended refunds, if requested, stretching back as far as 3 years, will be refunded in full. Additionally, House Bill 114 was amended in the Labor and Commerce Committee to amend the powers of an electrical cooperative to allow them to provide weatherization and energy efficiency products and services to their members. And I thank you for the support of this legislation.
If you get it. committee members, any comments? I'll make one. I'm not in favor of opting out for multiple reasons. Opting out is, by definition, says you get this unless you tell me you don't want it. You have to tell me you don't want it. But if you ignore me, you get it. And that, to me, is something that I've seen abused, not on a simple matter like this, but I've seen it abused with older people who get a magazine in the mail, says free, and the fine print says, unless you tell us not to send anymore, we'll continue to send you magazines and you will continue to be billed, and that goes on indefinitely. And so I'm very protective of this opt-in, opt-out statement. And I don't mind an opt-in statement. That's where somebody offers you something and you say, I like that, I'm in. And if they say, I'm offering you something and if you don't answer, you're in. That's the issue I have with it. It may not be important enough for people to vote no on the bill, but it's important to me, and so I intend to be a no vote on the bill because of the philosophy I have that says I think it's abusive to do something like this, even though it's for charity. I love charities. I give to charities. We all do. We're going to do something this weekend on a charity. We're going to volunteer our time and efforts. And those are all voluntary things. Nobody says to me, if you say you're not coming, then you're coming. No, I didn't say anything. So that's my issue with the bill. I've talked to the sponsor of the bill, and I told him I would hear it. And so that's what we're doing. We're hearing it. But that's my opinion. I feel it strongly that we shouldn't do something like requiring somebody to opt out because they may not know enough to do it. And I'll give you an example. All my utility bills are on auto pay. I will never see a question, do you want to opt in or opt out? Never. And so I will automatically be in, even though I never noticed that the question was there. So for me, if the bill said opt in, I'd have no problem, but as the representative says, it doesn't generate enough money. So what this represents is an ability of your utilities to take a little extra money from you and donate it to the charity of their choice. Well, I have charities of my choice. And we give substantially. Good years, we give a lot more. And I always pick the charities I want to give to. I have charities I object to. I haven't seen them listed here, but there are some. As a pro-life person, I do not give to Planned Parenthood. And so I don't give to charities that include Planned Parenthood in their collection of charities that they will donate to. But I don't have any way to check it. So since I don't have any way to check it, I prefer not to do it. And I don't have to, but to prevent myself from being involved, I have to take an action. And that's my objection. Anyone else? No one else on the committee? Have someone go open public testimony? So Homer Electric, Joe Gallagher, are you online?
Yes, I am online in Kenai, Alaska.
Yeah, we can hear you, Joe. Go ahead and identify yourself and your affiliation and give your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Gallagher, and I work with Homer Electric Association. And I wanted to speak just briefly about the amendment to House Bill 114, and that's the amendment that would allow an electric co-op to assist people in acquiring and installing weatherization and energy efficiency products and services. Currently, the Electric Telephone and Cooperative Act does allow cooperatives to finance the purchase of electrical and plumbing, appliance, fixtures, and apparatus. Homer Electric has used this Act. Actually, we have a line of credit program. It's been in place for at least 20 years now, and we make financing available to our members, and they use that again to purchase eligible items under the Electric and Telephone Cooperative Act.
Yeah, when you say we make financing available, they borrow money from you
That is correct.
And
we have a program.
And how do they pay it back? Do they pay it back on their bills? Do they pay it back at a certain percent? And if so, what percent would that be?
The payback is set up for a period of up to 3 years. The payback is not part of their bills. It is taken a draft from their bank account, a direct draft. The line of financing is, the interest rate for the line of financing is set at the same rate that Homer Electric can borrow money. I believe it's somewhere around 5.5% right now. And the maximum amount of money that can be loaned through the HVA line of credit program is $5,000. And the products that are purchased, the one requirement is that they must be purchased through a vendor that is located within the Homer Electric service territory and a member of Homer Electric.
So if they wanted to get a bid from an Anchorage vendor, that would be prohibited?
That's correct.
Okay.
Lately, over the last couple of years, Homer Electric has been very, very active in promoting energy efficiency with our membership. Our rates have increased due in a large part to the increasing cost of fuel. And so as our rates have increased, we have made a very significant effort to present our members with information that can allow them to take steps to decrease their usage and basically lower their electric bill.
No, just curious, what percentage of your generation is renewable, like hydro or something besides fuel?
Right now, Homer Electric Association is basically a distribution cooperative. We are under contract to purchase our power from Chugach Electric. So we are basically a power purchaser. Our power is purchased under contract from Chugach Electric. 90% of that power is based on natural gas generation. And the other approximately 10% is hydropower. So we are very much tied to the natural gas prices. And getting back again to our efforts to promote energy efficiency and weatherization, what that has done, the message has been heard loud and clear, and people have been taking steps over the last couple of years to make improvements. And many of our members have come into Homer Electric and have been interested in using our line of credit program to purchase weatherization materials. And unfortunately, due to the limitations in the wording of the Electric and Telephone Cooperative Act, we have not been able to include those in our line of credit purchases. So we basically had to tell them, no, if you came in to purchase maybe some new windows that were going to be energy efficient for your home, unfortunately, we would have to say, you know, we think that's a great idea. It's something that we've been promoting, but our line of credit program cannot be used to make that purchase. So we looked at this and thought if there was a slight amendment in the Act that would allow us to use the line of credit program to finance purchases of that type, it would be a very good deal for our members. So that was basically the thought behind including this amendment in HB 114. And we would ask for your consideration.
Okay, and I assume that amendment passed at the last judiciary meeting?
Labor and Commerce.
Yes, it did.
Oh, I'm sorry, passed in Labor and Commerce?
Yes.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
So it came to us as already incorporated in the bill. I don't have anyone else online to testify, but I'm going to ask if Annie Carpinetti would come forward. I do have a question.
My name is Annie Carpinetti. I represent the criminal division of the Department of Law, and I'm not going to speak.
And I understand that, but I think y'all, the question I have is pretty simple. Do we have any laws on the books that deal with opting in, opting out provisions that make one or the other illegal?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question, but if I were to, I would call somebody like Ed Sniffen.
I'm just about to do that.
To ask him, because he's much more familiar with our type consumer protection type
I see.
Provisions
okay.
than I am.
Well, hang right there. Ed Sniffen, you online?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I am.
Did you hear the question I had for Ms. Carpinetti?
Yes, I did, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ed Sniffen, Assistant Attorney General in the Anchorage office, and I enforce Alaska's consumer protection and antitrust statutes. And yes, Mr. Chairman, we do have a law that prohibits opt-out marketing plans. That's found in AS 45.45.900 and other provisions following 900. And that statute makes it illegal for anyone to offer an opt-out or engage in an opt-out marketing plan to sell goods or services using an opt-out plan.
So you're going to hear the obvious question. Does that mean that this bill really has language in it that's illegal?
Through the chair, this bill was generated in part because of a conflict with the program that Golden Valley and other electric cooperatives wanted to engage in, and whether or not these kinds of opt-out roundup programs would in fact violate that statute. The current law focuses on the sale of a good or service, and you cannot use an opt-out marketing plan to solicit or sell a good or service to a consumer. The roundup plans in question under this bill are plans that take your money and they use them to provide charitable donations. So the question is that charitable donation really considered a good or service that would be prohibited under AS 45.45.930? And we issued an informal letter to Golden Valley Electric and said, well, we think it probably is prohibited under this statute, but you know, the jury's out. A court might disagree with us. So they have proposed this legislation to resolve that conflict in favor of allowing these kinds of plans as opposed to not allowing them. Of course, that's entirely a policy call with the committee. I heard your comments, Mr. Chairman, at the start of the hearing, and I agree with you that opt-out plans generally are bad things. We don't like them in the consumer protection world, and we tell people they can't do them. This particular plan has a lot of features, though, that that differ markedly from the standard ills that you would find in a traditional opt-out marketing plan. And we've worked with Golden Valley to come up with some language here to get rid of at least most of the evils that we associate with opt-out plans. And so if you're going to have one, this is the kind of plan that provides some fairly significant protection to consumers. And for example, your example of consumers receiving magazines and a free one, and here you go, if you don't do anything, you're going to get more and you're going to have to pay for them. And if you don't pay for them, pretty soon you get you know, debt collection notices and your credit can be affected, and there are lots of bad things that can happen if you decide to ignore somebody who decides to give you something for free and then expects you to keep paying for it. Under this plan, you know, that could never happen. There's no recourse the cooperative can take against any consumer if they just completely ignore, you know, this plan. And if they do find out that they've been giving money and they didn't know they were giving money, you know, they can go back and get refunds. So there are features of this particular plan that resolve a lot of those issues. But again, we generally don't like opt-out plans, and I do agree with your comments that they're overall bad for consumers. But this one isn't necessarily a particularly bad one if you're going to decide that to allow these kinds of roundup plans.
So I'm
happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Yeah, so my next question is, this one is not particularly bad. Well, we would hope not. But is it the camel's nose under the tent?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I would hope not. And if it is, I think other plans that might come down the pike would have to come before the legislature, and the legislature would have to decide if they're the kinds of plans that they would want to allow. So, it's hard to say. And the other difficulty with this piece of legislation is I think Golden Valley Electric has probably the model plan in place that they intend to go forward with. They thought about this. They're responsible. But a lot of the things that Golden Valley Electric is doing under their plan is not required under this piece of legislation. And other cooperatives may not do it the same way that Golden Valley does. And we would have to see down the road if other utilities who would be able to do these kinds of plans were trying to abuse their system. And we just don't know what they would do, so it's hard to predict how this would ultimately impact these other utilities who decide to do this.
I just have to tell you, it makes me nervous. I know it's like 50 cents a month on average, 12 months, $6, every year is $18. That's nothing. It's not the money, it's the principle of whether or not we're going to make some exclusion for this opt-out plan. And I just don't want to break through the barrier. I think the existing law of saying you can't have those, but as soon as we say except for, we now have the crack in the armor. It may not be a big enough crack for anyone to crawl through, but I'm very nervous about it. Well, I'm not very nervous about it, but I am concerned that I don't want to do something that essentially is a violation of existing law, except maybe not a serious violation. So thank you for your testimony, and I appreciate it. Anyone else want to testify? Senator Terrio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We appreciate Representative Thompson introducing the bill on behalf of the co-op.
Can you tell us who you're representing?
Thank you. Yes, Gene Terrio representing Golden Valley Electric. Brian Newton would have been here today except for or online, but he did have a conflicting conference to go to and asked me to provide some comments on behalf of the utility today. We do appreciate this being introduced to clarify that the program that the co-op has gone to its members to get permission for is not an opt-out marketing plan. As Mr. Sniffen indicated, there was language that was put onto the statutes a number of years ago. In fact, the prime sponsor of the legislation was then Representative Kevin Meyer, now Senator Meyer. We have gone to Senator Meyer and explained the program that we would like to do or that we have initiated for our membership. And Senator Meyer indicated that the bill that he crafted and got through the legislature a number of years ago was not designed to exempt this type of activity. It was his intent at that time to prevent the things like when you would get a magazine and say the magazines are going to start coming and you're just going to automatically be billed. When we explained the way our program was put together, he indicated that that was not what he was trying to sweep in with the passage of that legislation. As Mr. Sniffen indicated, the Department of Law rendered an opinion that there could be confusion between this program and whether it did fit under that statute. And so what we're doing is asking for a clarification. I think one of the things that is a prime difference is that the program that was initiated by Golden Valley and would be allowed under this statute can only get started with an affirmative vote of the actual members who are going to see their bills rounded up.
Let me ask a question. When you poll the members, how many members are there? How many were polled, and what was the results of the poll?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I don't know what the threshold is in order to make our vote legitimate or legitimized. I believe the statute, though, talks about just like any vote that's taken by the membership of a co-op, we would have to meet the same threshold. I don't know what that number was when our vote was taken, but I do know that the votes that were cast, 70% were in favor of the program. So unlike a solicitation from a magazine or a solicitation for life insurance on a credit card or in conjunction with a credit card, in any of those instances, the public that is going to be potentially impacted was never given an opportunity to say yes or no, start this program. And that's a marked difference between what those programs that we believe fall under the existing statute and the program that is has been started by Golden Valley. It can only be started by an electric or telephone co-op, so only those classes of people that have standards and statutory standards for polling their voters. There has to be a certain threshold that's met as far as the votes being cast, and then it has to be an affirmative vote. It's only then that the program is started.
I have a question. When you did the poll, would it have been pretty simple to put a box there saying, if you approve of this, check the box to opt in and be done with this?
Mr. Chairman, for whatever reason, the question wasn't asked that way. And I think that the co-op looked at the 250 co-ops across the nation that do have the Roundup program, and those the level of success they get with an opt-in or an opt-out. And the decision, again, from our members, approved by our members, was that the opt-out was the
more successful for raising the money.
Yes.
And I have no doubt that that's true.
Yeah.
And that's the scary part.
Yeah. The other sideboards that I think are put on this is there has been mentioned that the members, we have to make it very clear to our members how they can opt out. We've made it so that they can do it with a simple phone call, stop by the office, mm-hmm. send an email. And I know the women that work around the part of the office that I am at right now, they receive those phone calls every morning and then take the simple steps to opt people out. In addition, because the individual rate-paying member can ask for 3 years worth of back contributions, if in fact they don't catch it immediately and all the advertising that we've had and discussing it at the annual meetings doesn't, press coverage on this legislation, if that doesn't give people adequate notice, anywhere along the line in the next 3 years, they can opt out and get all that money back. That refund of 3 years, I think, will also keep the independent board that's going to decide where the contributions are steered, is going to really keep them honest to supporting the types of programs that have broad support in the public. Because if, in fact, they start steering money into anything that is controversial with the majority of the public, those people will opt out and have the right at that point to ask for 3 years' worth of back contributions. So the cooperative is going to have to make sure that we have enough money held in reserve to refund up to 3 years from up to 100% of our participants.
I'm going to take this opportunity to give you a horror story because I'm involved in it. And my mom was a widow, some dementia, living by herself in New York City. And after years, when I visited her, she had a dial telephone. Ma had a cell phone. And I said, boy, this is an old phone. How come you never got the button phone? And she didn't know anything about what I was talking about, so I called AT&T, and they said, well, we gave her an opportunity 5 years ago to get the upgraded phone. And if she didn't get it, to keep the circle it out, she was being charged $15 or $25 a month extra to maintain that phone. And you can bet what you can almost guess what I told them. I said, here's a widow doesn't have the clue what you're talking about, and why don't you just give her the next phone? And they said, we gave her a chance. In fact, we gave her three chances, and she never responded. That, Mr. Terrio, is exactly the issue I have. She never responded, and so she was stuck. I don't know how much money she gave up, but you can count $15 or $25 a month over several years, and she was out the money. And I said, I want you to refund her money. Well, I think I got my way for about 3 months. But that's all they were willing to do. So, and that's a utility. The same thing we're talking about here. And that's why I object to this opt-in, opt-out provision. Opt in if you want. I don't care. Everybody can opt in. You opt in every time you throw $10 in the basket of church. But imagine if they said, we're going to take $10 out of your account unless you leave a note in the basket that you don't want to do it. That's my horror story. Personal. Probably happened to other people too. Had to. And the utility simply took advantage of people who they shouldn't have taken advantage of. I don't know if they knew her age or the fact that she was alone, but they took advantage of her. That's what I didn't like, and that's what I'm trying to prevent here.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, of course, the dollar amount that you've thrown out is substantially higher than this, and I can understand that perhaps you make more differentiation based on the dollar amount. But I think between that instance and the other direct marketing, as Mr. Sniffen has testified, the safeguards or sideboards that have been put in here have basically made the list of horrors that can befall a member very limited. And so that if there was any time that you wanted to offer this the roundup because of the public good that comes out of it, that we have structured it in a way so that we have separated out all of the potential of abuse. In the example that you gave, I don't know if the utility had an option where that you could get 3 years back. That's required by this legislation.
That was my argument to them. And I said, you took advantage of an old woman.
In addition, if your mother hadn't paid, if she had just opted to subtract that $15 off the bill, they probably would have gotten her for back amounts that she hadn't paid. And as Mr. Sniffen indicated, that can come back and cause problems to people on their credit ratings. In this instance, if there's a 50-cent roundup on your monthly bill and you haven't taken the step to opt out, but you just subtract that 50 cents off what you paid to the utility, nothing will happen to you. The utility has no ability to say, well, you shorted us by 50 cents last month. So you can either opt out or you can just make the decision each month to not include the penny or 50 cents or whatever it is.
Is this just for this utility or is it open to every utility?
It would only be for co-ops. So in the state of Alaska.
All the co-ops.
Only co-ops. And because, again, the co-ops are controlled by their members. The structure of the co-op is controlled by the votes of the members. This program would be controlled by a vote of the members. So there is a democratic process that has to take place before this program can even get underway.
Okay. Anyone else want to speak? I'm going to set this bill aside for now. Next bill is House Bill 175. Oh, before we get to 175, Donald House, are you online?
Hayes.
Donald Hayes, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am here. And I apologize for the late arrival. I was sent to the Senate Judiciary Committee twice when I called in.
Well, you've got your hands full. can you go through the... the reason you're online is to talk to us about an appointment to the Judicial Council, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, can you proceed with pretty much the same thing you probably told Senate Judiciary? You're the right guy for the job, and
they'll
vote at the end of your testimony.
All right, thank you. Yes, I was muted and I wasn't able to talk to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and all I did was hung up and called back.
Well, don't do that to us.
Okay. My name is Don Hayes. I'm 41 years old, and on graduating college in December of 1992, I made the decision to visit Alaska before beginning a career or pursuing further education. And the reason is basically just so I could see the state while I was young enough to climb the mountains, raft the rivers, hunt game, hike the trails, that type of stuff. Seeing the state so grand from a cruise ship or a bus in my retirement age didn't sound too appealing to me. Before long, I met my wife here in Valdez. We got married, settled down to raise a family. And I've been working over at the Valdez Marine Terminal since 1995 for various contractors. Currently, I'm an electrical designer for CH2M Hill, and I've spent the past 5 or so years upgrading the fire system line-wide.
Say that one more. Upgrading the fire systems?
that
yes.
what you said?
We were replacing the old, they call them dumb fire detectors with smart ones, where the system would know exactly which room is on fire when an alarm comes
so
in.
So this is in commercial buildings?
Yes.
Thank you.
And my experience with the courts is brief and positive. We went through two adoptions with two different judges, and I've had one stint as a juror, and I've had one mandatory appearance for a speeding ticket. My interest in this position stems mostly from my degree in political science, and while I chose not to get a law degree, I certainly took several pre-law related classes, and attaining such a degree is one of my options that I gave up when choosing to visit Alaska. My schooling gave me a firm grasp of how the system is designed to work and why it is set up as it is. What I have to offer, should you confirm me, is I've been on the Planning and Zoning Commission here in Valdez since 2004. I'm currently in my second term as chairman. And in this position, I've participated in public hearings and taking public testimony. I've learned how to weigh good arguments that come from all sides of an issue and then choosing the strongest one. I've participated in public discussion. Another thing I have to offer is I ran a campaign for State House in this past election, and District 12 is one of the largest geographically. I listened to and spoke with people in a wide swath of the state, from farmers to fishermen, Alaskans in oil, tourism, the military, education, mining. So I bring the breadth of that experience to the table. And finally, being a father has given me a broader perspective than I had as a young man, fresh out of college, with a quick answer to everything. I believe I'm more thoughtful, forward-looking, and inclusive than I was at one time. I believe it's vastly important that Alaska has a slate of unbiased, thoughtful, and considerate judges, and if confirmed, that's what I promise to you. Now, if I may, Chairman, could I direct my next comment to Representative Greenberg?
Please do.
Representative Greenberg, I want to first thank you for the delay. Monday, I've gone home sick from work, and I stayed home all day yesterday as well, and I really appreciate the time to recuperate before speaking before you all. So first off, thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
And then also, just before closing, you had asked me if I responded yes to a certain question on a public survey in the past election. At that time, I wasn't prepared to answer, but I have reviewed the survey question, and that question was, would you support a state constitutional amendment that would allow the governor the same leeway for appointing state judges as the U.S. president has for appointing federal judges? And yes, I did answer yes to that, which is what I guessed I had. As did Chairman Gatto, Representatives Lynn, Feige, Sadler, Millett, Dick, and Wilson. So I wasn't in the extreme of answering yes to that question. In fact, only two of your fellow representatives answered unknown, Representative Peggy Wilson and Representative Mike Hawker.
Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Mr. Hayes, you did very well. I could not have told that you were in other than top form on Monday.
Thank you.
I'm glad you're feeling better. I really am, because I have gone home sick a few days at various times, and I'm really, on a personal level, glad you're feeling better. And for the record, we have all seven of us here today, and I don't know that we were all here on Monday. So I think it's good that we're doing this today. Mr. Chair, I have a few questions, if I may just continue along with my questions.
Go ahead.
Thank you. You've had a chance, first of all, we have done some research on the issue of where people are from on the Judicial Council. And for the record, I've given out a bunch of information to the other members of the committee. I have a document that I haven't given out on this just because I got it a few minutes ago, and we'll try to make sure everybody gets everything. But the constitutional article that deals with the Judicial Council, and the members have copies of their constitution here, it's on page 19, it's Article 4, Section 8. And in the middle of the article is one sentence I would like to focus attention on. And I'm going to read it to you, Mr. Hayes. This is not a quiz or anything like that, but just so you see what I'm asking about.
Can you repeat that? You said it's page 19, Article
for Section 8, entitled Judicial Council.
Got it.
And about half the way down, 60% of the way down, quote, appointments shall be made with due consideration to area representation and without regard to political affiliation. Two requirements. Due regard, a due consideration to area representation is first, and I'll go into that, and then to the political affiliation second. I am informed that with the exception of a two-year gap from 1983 to 85, there has always been one public member from the first judicial district. That's generally the area of Yakutat South, I believe. And Valdez in your district would not be part of that. The language due consideration to area representation, I will concede for the purpose of discussion now that there's no requirement that there be somebody from the first judicial district. This is just an area, a point of consideration that the appointing and confirming authorities must look at. So I'm looking at this from a policy rather than a strictly constitutional point of view, with that admonition in mind. Since there is nobody from that part of the state, and since, from what I can see from your biography, your efforts have been turned north and central rather than to the southeast part of the state, tell me how you would, tell me why you feel you're qualified to represent that area and how you would intend to do so, what background you have, knowledge, and understanding of their problems, particularly judicial.
Yes, Representative, I certainly understand your concerns because Valdez has never had a representative on a judicial council. You know, any other community in Prince William Sound, Cordova, Chenega, Tetet Lake, Whittier, other communities in this area. In fact, the closest I believe I found was Seward, was the closest community that has been represented. The four regions of the state, the first region, as according to my count, had 24 people represented on the board since statehood. The third district, which I'm in, and also includes Anchorage, had 23 people, so I would bring that up to the same number as the southeast. And the third district, Fairbanks, fourth district, Fairbanks, had 20 people. So actually, if there is a district that's not covered, it would be the far north, Barrow and Kotzebue, which has only had two members represented. Now currently, I believe Miss Willoughby is from Juneau, so District 1 does have a representative on the commission, and I would be another one for the District 3.
Okay. Passing on to the other half of that constitutional provision, which says that, and without regard to political affiliation, I am informed at least within the last 9 years or so, there has not been anybody on the Judicial Council with as many political ties as you have. Specifically, I see from your biography that you're a member of the Republican Party Central Committee, and you've been appointed, and there's, I guess, still serving on the board of Eagle Forum Alaska. Am I correct in both of those assumptions?
A former member. I was a member of the Central Committee until 2008. And I have not been because I ran for office. I had to step down to participate in the primary, and I haven't been put back onto that committee. And I might add that Ms. Katie Hurley, a Democrat elected to the State House, was appointed at one time, and she served through 2003. So I don't see that having a partisan background is that necessarily a problem.
Okay. May I ask, are you still on the Eagle Forum board?
No, I resigned in December when I was considering taking this position.
I see.
And mainly that was just due to time constraints. I wouldn't have time to do both.
Now, Representative Grunberg, I'm a little uneasy with this line of questioning. I think we're trying to find out if he's a qualified candidate to serve, and even though the you mentioned the Constitution without political affiliation, I think he's made his case that everybody has a political affiliation of some kind, but we can't go and start making lists to determine whether it's too much or too little. So if we could kind of get off of that line of questioning. Do you have more questions?
Let me tell you where I was going, and I think you'll see it's tying in. I have a number of questions that the Eagle Forum asked in their questionnaire that we've alluded to, and some of them I think relate to potential issues that may involve the question of who is sent up from the Judicial Council to the governor. So what I would like to do is bring up some of these and to see, because I know how he answered. He answered yes to all of them on the questionnaire, and I'm wondering in each of the cases whether that is still his philosophy, and if so, specifically, whether that would influence him in any way in the types of candidates he would send up to the governor. And I'm tying it in specifically in that manner. Is that permissible?
I'm going to say that I think everybody is influenced by their background. And to pick here, I had some other questions maybe that were a little different, but I'm sure he has a political affiliation. If you asked him how he voted in the last election?
No.
No, if you did, you'd say, well, that's maybe the most important question. But to pick a series of questions that he answered affirmative to, these are all on the record now?
The questions and the answers are public documents. I mean, you can get them on the website and everything. But I'm trying to find out specifically whether these views would influence him, because a lot of them relate to constitutional interpretations, and it's quite important, at least in this representative's opinion, to know for the people who are going to make the decision on whom to send up to the governor whether that those candidates, judicial candidates, political views, whatever they may be, might influence the person if he's on the Judicial Council or not. I think that we, the public, and the rest of the legislature, who will be getting our report as we go into the joint session here, have a right to know if that sort of thing is going to influence a candidate's performance, and then they can make their own decision on whether they think that's a problem or not. But I think being able to get into this line of questioning, which specifically relates to the qualifications and criteria he would use when winnowing out candidates to go up to the governor, I think that's central to his function on the committee.
Don, can you, you've heard everything Representative Grunberg said?
Yes.
And without going through how you answered questions, can you make some comments that would help the committee to understand that you are more fair, that you are one-sided, that you are too conservative for us to vote yes on, too liberal for us to avoid voting yes on? I don't know. I'm looking at your resumes here. I think you've done a lot of good things, and I would kind of hope that whenever you're given some choices that your political affiliations aren't part of how you make your decisions. So can you make some comments back to the committee here?
Yes, absolutely. First, just for the record, that wasn't an Eagle Forum survey. It was an Alaska Family Council.
I stand corrected.
Let everybody know I wasn't, on the board of somebody asking questions to put out there in a biased way. But in my own political views, as much as I respect what Representative Grunberg is getting at, because I do want to see a balanced judiciary, as much as I respect that, I think that my own political views on such issues seem to be irrelevant for two reasons. First, judges don't make the laws. You guys do. And whatever I may have said while I'm running for the legislature indicated what I'd like to see happen in your body. And I would be upset, and I hope you would be too, if a judge took it upon himself to create the law as if he were a member of your body.
And it's my firm commitment to you that on taking this job, I'll ignore a judicial candidate's partisan views, and I'll put forward only the most qualified candidates. And not only is that my commitment, but it's also what I will swear to, because our bylaws say, and I'll quote, say that the council shall actively encourage qualified members of the bar to seek nomination to such offices, shall endeavor to prevent political considerations from outweighing fitness, and that's the part that's important right there. And then also on section 2 where it says concerning retention of judges, again it says, the council shall endeavor to prevent political considerations from outweighing fitness in judicial retention. So that's going to be something I have to swear to, and I will stand before God and live up to that.
And we appreciate that. Let me see if I can add a little lightness to this.
On your
experience, it says CH2M Hill.
Yes.
Slash Vico. I guess Vico's, I'm not sure. Did you add Vico because in the year 2000, that's who you worked for? Or
yeah.
Have you always worked for CH2M Hill?
No, I got hired on as Vico, and then after the whole corruption scandal, Vico was sold to CH2M, which is about, I believe, 10 times the size that Vico was in his prime.
So here's my question. CH2M Hill, I understand every one of the characters represents something.
Oh, no. It stands for the four members who formed it, and their names started with a C, two of them started with H, and one started with an M.
Oh, well.
And then later they merged with a Hill company, so they added Hill to it.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember the names, I'm sorry.
It's fair, because most of us have said, how'd they come up with this name? And I said, you know, it's a catchy name. Whatever it took to be a catchy name, people recognize it. And I do understand they were substantially larger than Vico, and they just took over the Vico operation. Okay.
Yes, and for the record, I have never met any of the criminals that have gone to jail. I'm just a peon at the bottom of the ranks.
Okay, thank you. I see Laugh Out Loud Productions. I'm impressed that you were active in producing and promoting tourist season plays, and you acted yourself, about carpentry and concrete work. You've done maintenance and drywall. You sound to me like what I'm after is not just someone who's a political animal, but someone who understands the community and that people actually have jobs and what they do in their jobs and that the jobs are hard. So I want you to know that I did appreciate your resume here, even though your journey is in political science.
Oh.
You don't know how much fun that was.
And you think this will be as much fun?
Oh, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of...
I failed to mention that Representative Holmes and Representative Lynn have joined us some time ago. So Representative Holmes has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With your permission, I think I actually have two questions. Following up on a slightly different tact on the issue you and Representative Grinberg were asking about, trying to get a general feel for Mr. Hayes's philosophy of the job of the Judicial Council, there's some debate, I would say, among Alaskans about whether the role of the Judicial Council is to send up only the most qualified candidates or to send the names of all qualified candidates to the governor. And I'm curious if Mr. Hayes has what Mr. Hayes's view is on that question.
Mr. Hayes, you heard that question? Most qualified or all qualified?
Well, it has to be a minimum of two, and I would tend towards sending more rather than fewer, with the main criterion being how qualified they are. And if we had three very qualified people, I'd have a hard time narrowing it down and just sending two.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that answered that question. The second one I have is on a totally different tact. We've discussed, Mr. Hayes, the fact that you did run for office recently, and this is a six-year commitment. Obviously, this is a fairly important role that you would be taking on, and it is a six-year term, and I believe you would not be allowed to run for any public office while holding this term. Is that something that you are comfortable committing to?
Yes. Of course, with redistricting coming before us, I may not even have the same district that I ran in last time. But if I do, I'm very pleased with the person who beat me in the primary. So I can't see myself running against him if for some reason I was put into the same district. And aside from that, I had no intention of running to begin with. What happened was a friend of mine dropped out to go work on the oil spill down in Louisiana. So I was a late step in to take his place. And should another election come forward, I'm pretty certain his name will be on the ballot again, and I wouldn't want to run against him.
Mr. Chairman, that's exactly how I ended up in my seat, so I understand that. I got equipped 18 hours before the filing deadline, so I understand that perfectly. Thank you. Those were my questions for the moment.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Gruenberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm informed that in the past you've posted several blogs criticizing Alaska's liberal, that's in quotes, judges and courts. Was that correct? That information?
I'm not sure which blog you would be referring to. For several years, I was the person who posted to the Eagle Forum blog. Is that maybe what you're talking about?
Yes, I believe that's it. Let's assume that that's what the information meant. Could you explain what you mean by, or what you meant by the term, quote, liberal?
Certainly. Those posts that I made were just pass-throughs from other people because we didn't want somebody to get on there and start saying a bunch of outrageous stuff or offensive things where they might swear and cuss. So we were moderating what was posted, and the chairman of the Eagle Forum would forward those on to me after her approval, and I just posted them to save her the time of doing it.
Okay.
So, you know, you could say that I probably agreed with most of them. That would be a fair assumption. But you certainly couldn't say that I agreed with all of them. I just posted them.
If I may follow up, please.
Okay, we're going to take these one at a time, but go ahead.
Yeah, of course. And Mr. Chair, if you feel uncomfortable, please, you should shut me down.
I'll let you know.
Yeah. Do you feel that most or a number of our judges in this state at any level are too liberal?
Certainly not the ones that I've met or that I've dealt with. I've had a very positive experience.
Would you be using any type of guideline or criterion in your determination of who to send up to the governor based on whether a person is, quote, liberal or conservative?
No, absolutely not. What I would be looking for in a judge is more of their interpersonal skills. I'd like to see that, you know, when they convict somebody, they could make it look like it was a favor to the defendant, or that the victim would feel that justice has been done. The ability to make all sides feel that they've been heard and understood, even if the decision goes against them. That's the kind of stuff I think is much more important than their political views. If all I wanted to do was change politics, I'd stick with elected office because, frankly, the judges don't have that much power to change politics in our system. And the hot-button issues like, I don't know, abortion or gun rights, those type of issues would rarely come before a judicial candidate because they're going to be dealing with traffic fines and domestic violence and, you know, smaller crimes. So it would be kind of a waste of my time to come to this board if I was just trying to change the political culture of our state.
I'm going to ask you a question here. When you look at the judges, do you feel like the judges make interpretations or decisions based on their personal views or based on the facts before them?
Well, I would certainly hope that they do it based on the facts before them, that their personal views would have nothing to do with it.
And that's how you would make your decisions too?
Yes.
So you're looking at qualified people and... I guess you can have qualified people that lean right or lean left or kind of don't lean at all. But
when I would think so.
When you're trying to pick the best person, and I'm hopeful that you'll say, listen, I'm only looking for the smartest and nicest and best person that can do this job and not the person who more reflects my viewpoints or my opposition's viewpoints. Am I correct?
Right, absolutely.
Okay, well, we're going to... We confirm you, we're going to depend on you to live up to that because I think that's the most important thing for the committee.
I understand.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg wants some follow-up questions.
Thank you. Would it make any difference to you in, and all of these relate to the, I'm not talking about retention now, I'm talking about the winnowing out of candidates for initial appointment. Would it make any difference to you whether or not a person had been divorced?
No, I wouldn't think that would have anything to do with it.
How about their sexual orientation?
No.
Gender?
To be honest, I'd kind of wonder how I would even know on that issue.
Representative Holmes has a question about would gender make a difference.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm following up on my colleague Senator McGuire, who I believe went off on this issue in Senate Finance the other day. There are soon to be no women on the bench in the 3rd Judicial District. So, and I don't blame the Judicial Council. In my understanding, has been sending up qualified women. They just haven't been getting chosen. So, I would like to use this little bully pulpit to express my views on the fact that we have a massive gender inequality on the bench at the moment that's getting worse. The final woman from the 3rd Judicial District is retiring from the bench, and I think having no women in the largest trial court in the state is appalling. So I'm not so much asking this as using this as a bully pulpit to let Mr. Hayes know of my personal feelings on that issue.
So, Mr. Hayes, then the question is, rather than pick the most qualified candidates, you would pick at least one qualified woman candidate to make sure that there was an opportunity. Would you do something like that, or do you stick with the most qualified?
No, sir, I would stick with the most qualified. I find it hard to believe that there wouldn't be a qualified female, but if there wasn't, I wouldn't choose one that was unqualified just to meet some arbitrary standard.
Mr. Chairman, I have no problem with that. I'm not asking Mr. Hayes to pick unqualified women for the bench. Just to be clear, I think there are plenty of qualified female candidates out there, and in fact, the Judicial Council has sent many of them up, their names up in recent years.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
And so you've been asked questions about gender, sexual orientation, divorces. I hope, Representative Gruenberg, we're not going to continue in this line of litmus tests.
No, I wanted to avoid litmus tests, you know, but I'm not going to continue in that line. I'd like to go to a slightly different.
Okay, let's pick a slightly different one, but we're going to run out of time here.
This is, I think, my last area of inquiry.
Perfect.
Only about 70 more questions. No.
Very brief. Four parts for each question.
At that point, you would shed me out in your office.
I'm looking at the clock and where I intend to vote on Mr. Hayes here before we leave.
Well, yeah, it's like one question.
Go ahead.
One thing that has concerned me, and I just need to put on the record, that many, many years ago, when I had been in practice barely 5 years, I think, the bare minimum number of years to apply for the Superior Court, I did apply. And I did not get sent up. They asked if I'd apply again, and I said I didn't know it wouldn't make any difference. But I did go through the process, and I feel I'm better qualified to do this than that, but that's neither here nor there. The question was, the screening process itself, I'm not talking about the council's deliberations. I'm talking about the questioning of the candidates and the interview process. At least it wasn't at the time, and I think it's still the case, are not public meetings open to the public. They're not televised. Do you know, am I correct in that, Mr. Hayes?
You know, I've read through a lot of paperwork in the last 2 weeks, and I believe what I've heard is that it's up to the candidate themselves if they want a public interview or a private interview.
If that is the case, do you think that the council should re-examine? Well, I'm going to put a statement on the record, and you can do with it what you wish. I tend to think that open meetings is a very important concept, and so are the public records laws. And I would hope that the council at some point would be open to providing maximum public access to not their deliberations, but the interviewing process, so that the public and the press would be able to know the qualifications of the candidates and also how the members of the council are looking at the candidates and judging of them. And I just would welcome any comments you would have. You don't need to answer that. That's just my own view.
Well, I'll certainly take that under advisement. I tend to agree that doing it out in the open is the best way, but I also kind of feel for them. If, you know, somebody might be a little bit shy and might feel nervous being in front of a large crowd. I'm not sure why it was written that way.
I have been too simplistic in my views. I appreciate your answer very much, and I appreciate your answers to all my questions. They weren't the easiest questions. I don't know that I would have wanted to answer them, but I felt they had to be asked, and I appreciate the chair's leeway in letting me ask them.
Okay. That conclude the questions?
Yeah.
Vice Chair Thompson?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have reviewed the qualifications of Mr. Donald Haas, and I recommend that we forward his name to the full body for confirmation.
And your signature here does not become a recommendation. Your signature here is simply that we have reviewed his qualifications and we're forwarding his name to the full body for confirmation. Is there an objection?
No.
Seeing and hearing none, so ordered. Thank you, Mr. Hayes. Appreciate your time, and it was fun talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Take a little at ease so we can sign things. Which begins with a letter from our Attorney General, John J. Burns, and briefly, I think we're talking about 24 to 48 hour deadlines. We have a sectional analysis, and I believe, Ms. Carpinetti, are you the one that will speak to this bill? Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. We did have a hearing on this bill already, but I will briefly review. Would you like me to briefly review what was said at the last hearing?
Please do. I'm sure I missed it.
Okay, I'm sure you did.
You did.
Last year, the legislature enacted a fairly sweeping rewrite of our bail statutes, which had not been reviewed since 1968. And one of the changes that was made to the bail law was change from 24 to 48 hours, the deadline within which a person arrested should be brought in front of a judicial officer. Now, that's just the deadline. The law still requires that a person be brought without unnecessary delay in front of a judicial officer, but in any event, within 48 hours.
What happens if we exceed 48 hours? Does he get off, or does he...
It depends. That's a possibility, yes, that the charges would be dismissed. But unfortunately, and I take responsibility for this mistake, that bill changed the court rules addressing the issue, but it failed to change the statutes. And this bill makes that change, and it does it in two places, in our arrest statutes, in 1225-150A, and also in our extradition law, because the extradition law has the same provision.
So when we have a conflict like that, and the arresting officer brings someone in, what actions can happen when you're stuck between 24 and 48?
I think in the state, the officers and the correction systems are following the statute in
24
hours, yes.
And so that's what we're here for, is to...
To correct that, yeah, or make the two conform. There are three other inconsistencies between our statutes and our court rules that have arisen over the years for various reasons. The second one is the offense of driving without a driver's license in your possession in Title 28 is a Class B misdemeanor. At the same time, it's on our bail schedule as a $50 correctable offense. So this bill would specify that that offense is an infraction, so that it can go on, it continue to be on the bail schedule at a correctable $50 fine. The third issue that the bill addresses is the crime of failure to carry proof of automobile insurance when you're driving. And that is in our statutes now in Title 28, a Class B misdemeanor with a mandatory minimum fine of $500.
The words failure to carry, is proof that the same as not carrying the proof even though you are insured?
Or this is only failure to carry proof of insurance. It's not, it doesn't address failure to have insurance.
Even though you're completely insured, you better have the card.
Yes.
With you.
Yes.
Now, what if you had an expired card that showed the insurance company, the insurance number? Would the arresting officer simply make a phone call and determine that, or would he just follow the law and say, you don't have proof?
Chairman, I think it would depend on the circumstances. I suppose it would depend on what the circumstances of the stop were and various other things.
Maybe they were texting.
Right. this offense right now is also on our bail schedules as a correctable offense, so a person can just mail in a citation. It has the mandatory fine of $500, but it's inconsistent to have an offense on the bail schedules because those are infractions that don't require a court appearance, and at the same time have the statute say that they're a Class B misdemeanor. So this bill, at the suggestion of law enforcement, actually solves the problem by making the offense an infraction rather than a misdemeanor. It keeps the mandatory $500 fine because that was recently enacted by the legislature in the last 5 years. So that provision was kept in the statutes. But that's how that inconsistency.
Is that the maximum or the established fine?
Well, that's in statute. It's not the maximum. It's a mandatory fine of $500. Interestingly enough, that's in Title 28, and infractions in Title 28, if they're not specified in the statute like this is, would be subject to a $300 fine. Right. So I am assuming that the mandatory fine is
practical. So you go to court, mandatory. You prove to the judge that you have the insurance, and then the fine is forgiven?
Well, you don't even have to go to court. What you can do is go to the police agency that issued the citation and show them that you had insurance, and the same thing for driver's license, show them that you had at the time of the incident.
We have a good question from my neighbor here.
My name is Keller. I just want to take advantage where we have an expert here in front of us, and I have a question I've had, and I don't have the law in front of me. When a proof of insurance, does this specify a written card, or can it be like your cell phone that you call up? Because my insurance company, I can get the electronic version in moments. Is that does that count? Do you know, or do the law address that? Just curious.
I don't think it through the chair, Representative Keller, I don't think the law addresses that issue, because that's a fairly new phenomenon.
Yeah.
But maybe you might consider it.
Sometime. Cooper might be real nice, right?
And the fourth inconsistency that the bill addresses is one that arose over the last, since 2005, I think, 2006, the legislature created the Kinnick River Public Use Area. And in the statutes that created that public use area, they provided that offenses in the public use area were infractions, and they directed the court system to adopt a bail schedule for infractions that occur in that area. One of the infractions that was made was adopted by the Department of Natural Resources was burning a vehicle in the area. Later in 2008, the legislature passed arson in the third degree, which makes it a Class C felony for a person to cause an explosion or burn a vehicle on any public land, state or municipal. So that creates a problem, that burning a vehicle in the Kinnick River public use area is an infraction, which is in fact a $50 fine, and every place else, which is a Class C felony, which has all the consequences, jail, and possible jail time and fines and other things that are associated with that Class C felony. So this bill excludes that particular bad act, so it provides that the penalties in the Knick River area are as stated in law, except for under the arson in the third degree provision. So now arson in the third degree, burning a vehicle in all public lands, including the Knick River public use area, would be a Class C felony.
And private lands?
The statute only made the crime of burning a vehicle under these circumstances a crime on public land.
You burn a car in your yard? Legal?
Well, I guess it would depend on the circumstances and if you endangered anybody else. But it wouldn't, at least it wouldn't violate this particular provision of arson in the third degree. So that's House Bill 175. I really appreciate your hearing it.
Representative Grunberg?
I may introduce an amendment that you have. I didn't want to impinge on this questioning.
Well, I think we're done, pretty much done with the bill. Anyone else want to testify?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I was looking in the audience, and I don't see anybody. So, Representative Grunberg, do you want?
I would like to have Mr. Quinlan Steiner.
You step forward into the barrel for the tough questions.
I think this may be the first time, or one of the first times, we've had Mr. Steiner here in person. I mean, this year? No, I meant this year.
Is that right?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Quinlan Steiner. I'm the director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency and the public defender of the state of Alaska. And I think this is my first live appearance this year. Thank you for the opportunity.
You've not been initiated yet.
Correct.
We're working on it.
And I welcome, I signed up to answer questions, and I welcome any questions on the impacts of this bill.
Bloomberg has a question for you.
You and I mean this. This is a very nice committee. We're very friendly, and we're glad to have you here. I think I speak for everybody in saying that. Mr. Steiner, have you had a chance to review the bill?
To the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, I have reviewed the bill.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a general question because we chatted a moment ago, and I would appreciate the agency's comments on any aspect of the bill. I'm making that general.
Just a question or multiple questions?
No, that's my question.
Oh. Through the chair, my general comments relate to the 48 hours. This bill specifically is bringing it into alignment with the prior statute that was changed, the prior change that was done last year. I would just reiterate my concerns with the 48 hours of arrest and just highlight what the actual impacts of this might be. Having someone arrested brought before a judicial officer within 48 hours can delay the process in the lower level cases. This, of course, will apply to all cases, and so you get the low level cases where somebody might have an opportunity to be released but just doesn't have the funds and can't discuss bail with the magistrate. That person could potentially be delayed to 48 hours. But in addition to that, the right to bail, a bail hearing, doesn't accrue until 48 hours. And they have 48 hours to schedule a bail hearing. So in reality, if somebody has a bail that's too high or a third party placed upon them on a lower level offense, they may actually spend up to 4 days in jail. Not that it's required at 48 hours, but this kind of thing might tend to relax the response of the state to bail and arraignment. And that's the concern that we have with this. So this specific bill is just bringing it into alignment with what the legislature did last year.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's the first time, in my recollection, anybody has advanced that particular argument this year. I may be incorrect in my recollection, but that does concern me. In a low-level offense, not being able to get an opportunity to make bail for 4 days, that's a long time for a misdemeanor to go. Do you have any proposed language?
I haven't proposed any language, and I think the reason why that probably hasn't been discussed this year is it's just a conforming bill, and those concerns were brought forth when the original bill was, when the original language was changed to 48 hours. There was a lot of discussion about the mechanism of bail, arraignment, and then how it relates to the first bail hearing of right, and that can be delayed. So you got 48 hours for the having bail set before a magistrate, and then the requirement for 48 hours for the first bail hearing. So under certain circumstances, third-party custodians are the starkest example of that, because somebody gets arrested. It may be kind of a low-level offense, but a magistrate may feel that a third-party custodian is required under these circumstances. That, of course, isn't going to happen at that point. And no one's going to be able to get a third party before the magistrate, so they're going to have to request a bail hearing, and that will often require counsel. And so the delays are built in, which may make sense for the highest level offenses and not be that big of an impact. But as you get down on the level of offenses, it has a much greater impact. And I just highlight that as a concern. One of the impacts that I would foresee as this gets relaxed.
Sam Grunberg, another question?
Well, this is kind of to you. And something I said last time when I think Ms. Carpinetti or somebody said a lot of this was talked about last year. I think I just was asleep at the switch on that. And it was apparently a big deal. And I do apologize. I'm very concerned about hearing this. And, Mr. Chair, how do you want to proceed? Because I do think we should take a look at that discrete issue in the context of this bill and what we did last year. I don't know how you want to proceed. The rest of the bill seems fairly non-controversial, and it seems that this may be appropriate for serious offenses, but maybe not for some of the lower level. Do you wish to explore that, if so, how?
Let me ask Mr. Steiner, basically your thoughts on passing this bill out as is, or do you feel that, in your opinion, and I understand it's your opinion, that we ought to hold it and bring up this point the next time we meet?
You know, my view is that right now, the way the bill is working is it became clear. I don't think anyone picked up on the problems last year until after it was passed, and the judges sort of realized that they still had to follow the statute, and so they're still conforming with the 24-hour rule. Mm-hmm. What of concern to me is, you know, why is this necessary? What advantage is it to the state? And can that be accomplished if there is an actual reason to do this on just the cases where it might actually be required versus all cases? What I'm concerned is, once you relax it to 48 hours, I'm hopeful that the courts will still comply with the 24-hour rule, because that's sort of the what they're used to, but I'm concerned that relaxing it will result in standard operating procedures 48 hours to 48 hours. But I couldn't really say for sure what's going to happen. It may be that this gets passed and everyone does a 24-hour, brings them before a magistrate in 24 hours, and except in the most extreme cases where it actually has some use that's necessary. But I just I'm concerned that that won't happen. It'll just delay the process.
So we already have the court rule changes. This is just
about, yeah, it was just the statute.
And the judge can do a 24. So.
No, it's the state. It's... You know, the troopers bring them forward, and then there's a magistrate available. I mean, the whole it could really get bogged down at any stage of the proceeding. It's not the judge that brings the case forward. The person gets arrested, and then the police have to bring them before a magistrate to set bail.
So I guess I'm going to go back to the original question. In your opinion, should we address this question, or think we can pass this out in the next 1 minute?
Well, because this actually is going to have the effect of changing it, I would hope that everyone's comfortable with addressing the issue, that it be addressed and discussed and the impact be considered before passing anything.
And in your mind, the consideration that would work the best would say what?
Yeah, I didn't really actually develop any language to sort of address my concerns. I had, to be honest, assumed that the debate had occurred last year, and as a conforming amendment, it probably would be discussed only on those terms. But I think it's an important issue to discuss. I think if this is going to be put into effect, it ought to be considered, the impact that it may have on the lower level cases.
Representative Keller?
I picked up, I think, that you said you had a concern when you came to the committee today, but you signed up for questions. I'm just really curious, I mean, how the process works. Were these concerns discussed in the Department of Law?
I've expressed these concerns to the Department of Law, and I expressed them before both committees on the House and Senate side last year, I believe, when it was passed. I signed up for questions. I just assumed that the discussion was going to be limited to whether or not this appropriately conforms to what the legislature intended in the prior session, but hadn't really considered that the entire debate of the issues would be reopened.
So we've already passed the court rule changes.
Yes.
And we're just trying to conform to the court rule changes. And if we don't conform to them by changing this, then we're going to have to choose to either conform or go back to the court rule changes and redo those, which I don't think we're ready to do. So in order to conform, are we stuck with what the bill says?
Yes, this would conform with what the legislature did last year.
And
in the prior legislature.
Can you come forward and do you have any comments about, are we going to get ourselves in a bind here? We either pass it as it's written to conform to the court rule changes, or we have to change one or the other.
Mr. Chairman, the reason I wanted to mention, just respond to one thing that Mr. Steiner said was, it would not be 4 days before somebody got a bail hearing in a lower level case. And, you know, if you look at the bill, the bill says a person shall be taken before a judicial officer without unnecessary delay. Mm-hmm. So what we're talking about is a deadline, and right. Most courts and most prosecutors and most systems are geared up to bring people in within 24 hours. But there are those cases where the person is arrested in the middle of the night at 2 or 3 in the morning. They can't get the paperwork to the police and or to the district attorney in time to make rational judgments. The victim is unable to get to, the victim has a right to go to these bail hearings. And when they have it within 24 hours, sometimes the victim is in the hospital. We're unable to contact the victim to give them notice. Most cases, we would continue to bring them in within 24 hours, but this is just a deadline. I mean, the law will still require us to bring them in without unnecessary delay. But just in terms of the one point that Mr. Steiner said about 4 days, the law provides that in felony matters, the court can delay a bail hearing for 48 hours after the initial appearance in front of the court, so that in important matters, they can parties, including the defense and the prosecution, can get their ducks in line for a more rational bail argument in felony cases. That 48-hour delay does not apply to misdemeanors. So in the lower-level cases, it would be unusual in the extreme for 4 days to pass before a person is bail is considered for a misdemeanor offense.
Are we still on the original version A? We haven't had a change.
Yes.
So, Mr. Thompson, would you go ahead and move House Bill 175 for me?
Sure. May I be here for a minute?
Do you have a question?
Well, I have a
series of questions.
I do.
How many?
Two.
Can they be done in a few minutes?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Let's do a couple minutes here.
Yeah. This, I'm getting slightly different versions here. Because we don't have everybody in enough time to dialogue on this. What I'm wondering is, would we have time to deal with this on Friday briefly, and we can maybe talk to these people and see if we can get something cleared up between now and then?
The thing is that I'm satisfied that this is the bill we're going to deal with. I don't believe we're going to change anything in this bill because we want it to conform. And once we get outside of this bill, we don't conform anymore. And then we have to back up and what? Change the court rules? I'm not ready to do that. So unless you have another question, I'm going to take
I do have an amendment.
Okay, offer your amendment.
Okay, I think the members should have amendment number one, which we did discuss. It's A1. We discussed this on Monday, Mr. Chair, and it is a severability clause because there have been raised potential constitutional amendments concerning the right to bail. And I know we have a general severability clause in Title I. Occasionally, we put a severability clause in the individual bill, not because it may technically be necessary, but to give people notice that we specifically want to be sure that the other provisions in the bill are not struck down. I don't think they would be
I don't know that it's an earth-shaking thing, but I think it may be a belt and suspenders kind of thing, but it's, I'm offering it, and if the committee doesn't like it or you don't, I can withdraw it.
So, Ms. Carbonetti, is it, since we have the general severability clause, is this helpful or...
Mr. Chairman, through the representative, I don't have any disagreement with what Representative Gruenberg said. I think we have a general severability clause that would apply, but I don't think this hurts. I think, yeah. I like your analogy of belt and suspenders.
We're adding the belt to
yes.
the suspenders.
Yes. Right.
It hasn't been moved.
Oh, I move it.
Amendment number one. We have amendment number one before us, and Representative Keller objected. Representative Keller.
Yeah, I, you know, if it doesn't hurt anything, go for it. But I think that it may, in the sense that it red flags it unnecessarily as a concern, and you, I bow to your experience and understanding and respect your concern, but I just don't see we're going from 24 to 48 hours. Raises the level of constitutional concerns I've had in other bills, so I'll remove my objection if nobody else cares.
Respond. I absolutely agree with you, but this is so red flagged now. Everybody knows about this. I just want to be sure that the court doesn't screw it up.
So we're adding the belt to the suspenders. I don't have an objection. Anyone else have an objection? If there's no objection, amendment number one passed. Now, Mr. Thompson, can we go to the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I move that we move House Bill 175, 27-LS0579/A1 as amended from committee with the attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is there an objection? Seeing and hearing none, bill moves from committee. Let's get our name signed on there and
go to our next meeting.
Have one?
Yeah.
Another day's work.
We're still on.
That was a good debate.
Still on. Where's your